This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to five women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229, or visit preborn.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. Well, shortly after the 2016 presidential election took place, former Congressman Barney Frank said, "I am very mad at James Madison, but I don't think there's anything I can do about it." And this was a reference, of course, to that pesky liberal barricade of the Electoral College. But we know liberals get mad at other early presidents, too. Thomas Jefferson has been described by the Huffington Post as a slave trading landed elite whose esteem for farmers is often confused under contemporary politics with a small is beautiful rural utopianism. What is the truth, though, about the men who led our nation from its inception through the early 20th century? That's what we're going to talk about today with Dr. Larry Schweikert, who is a retired professor of history at the University of Dayton and the New York Times bestselling co-author of A Patriot's History of the United States. And I'm really thrilled he's got out a new book we're going to talk about. It is called The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Presidents, Part One, From Washington to Taft. And so good to have you here, Dr. Schweikert. Welcome.
Thanks. It's always good to speak with you, Janet.
You too. So you're known for setting the record straight on history. What has concerned you about how a lot of these presidents that you mentioned in the book are portrayed by the media and also the university crowd?
Well, I think it's pretty common for people to use a form of presentism, which is that we always try to put people in the context of what we know today, how we act today, how we're supposed to act today, and completely ignore how things actually were in the past and how people behaved in the past, not just us, everybody, and then to expect people to do things out of context with their time and place, it's just silly. It's ridiculous. Did Andrew Jackson hate Indians? Sure. Almost all whites back then hated Indians. Almost all Australians hated Aborigines. Almost all Slavs hated the Greeks. Almost all Muslims hated the Africans. I mean, go on and on and on. There was this kind of racial component back then that was just very common among all people.
Right.
So to apply present-day standards, and the term that's always used is presentism, it warps everything.
Yeah, and doesn't that demonstrate really a form of elitism, which I know academia is well known for, as are the media, of saying that we are the arbiters of history. We alone can interpret history, and we are the greatest generation. We got everything right, and these guys in the past were a bunch of small-minded morons. I mean, that's somehow, you know, that's how they come across oftentimes when they're talking about presidents, as if they're better, and they know more, and they are superior morally and intellectually, perhaps, to some of the founding fathers and the presidents.
Well, sure. And I think there's no small degree of jealousy there that, in fact, Jefferson and Madison thought of these ideas 200 years before they did.
Right. Yes, that's true, too. That's true, too. So let's talk a little bit about the presidency itself. As you've mentioned in the book, we've seen quite an expansion of powers of the executive branch under Obama. But when you go back and you look at how the presidency was viewed by the founders and by the presidents who served early on in the history of the United States, what kind of picture becomes starker to all of us when we see the contrast between the Obama years and the early years of the presidency?
Well, I think one thing that jumps out is that almost all of these men, they were all men, spoke in terms of not small government or big government, but good government. And to them, good government usually consisted of more localized government. They almost all, certainly up to at least the Civil War, they were all believers in what we would call the Whig theory of government, W-H-I-G, coming down from the English, John Locke, that said that the legislature should be the primary motivator in shaping and developing laws, and the executive, in their experience, it was usually a governor, other than, of course, King George, that the executive should be secondary, should take his cue from the legislature. And, you know, Washington believed that, Jefferson believed that, Madison believed that. Problem is, as soon as they got into office, and it doesn't start with Obama, but as soon as Washington gets into office, he finds out he can't do that because he's immediately confronted with some very serious national security concerns, most notably that there's almost a war ready to break out between England and France, and each of them wants us to declare who we're going to fight with. And Washington knows we can't survive another war, let alone a war with both of them.
Right.
And so he's looking for an option to get out of that, and that forces him right off the bat to do something that he doesn't want to do, which is he has to act without Congress. And he develops a very clever solution, basically saying, we have a peace treaty with France, so we're going to honor peace with France. And that's all we're not going to ally with them. We're just going to be at peace with them.
Right.
But he doesn't go to the Senate for that. And then we have Jefferson just a few years later, Jefferson has the same issue. He wants to obtain rights to deposit supplies and goods in New Orleans, sends Livingston over to negotiate. Livingston says they're offering to sell us all of the country, whole continent, for $15 million.
Yeah.
And Jefferson knows, I really should take this to the Senate, but the deal's going to be off the table by then. Buy it. Of course he's got to buy it. So these kinds of things come up over and over again, and they help develop a strong executive that, honestly, there was no other choice.
Well, what I find striking, though, is some would take that information and say, doesn't that point out that the founders were wrong about how they set up the branches of government, that it was all meant to be a balance of power, but that clearly it was flawed. And so in the modern context, the president should have a lot more authority than the founders thought he should. What do you think about that?
Well, I wouldn't say flawed. I would say that any system develops itself through practice and pragmatic working out, the working out of government. And you see this with Washington, when as soon as he's appointed, he goes, we haven't thought of this. I'm going to need some help. I'm going to appoint some secretaries to assist me. And then he didn't ask Congress's permission. He just sent them a note. I'm hiring some help. I'm hiring a secretary of treasury. I'm hiring a secretary of state. I'm going to have some offices because clearly I can't do this alone. Well, so you would say that the Constitution has, in fact, provided for most of this through the elastic clause that Congress has the authority to enable this after the fact when somebody says, we need this, and Congress says, yeah, we agree, you needed that.
Yeah. Well, what about the developments that you talk about in the book leading to expanding executive reach? You mentioned some of those instances right there with Washington and Jefferson. But you also talk about 1824 and the birth of the second American party system. What do we need to know about that?
Well, this is something that really was unanticipated by anyone except Hamilton. Hamilton was really the only founder who said, you can't get away from political parties. And Washington is just ranting about how bad parties are. We've seen a little of that today.
They
can be pretty nasty, right?
Yes.
But Madison, you can just see these guys sitting in a room, and Washington and Jefferson are ranting against parties, and Madison's over there in the corner shaking his head, no, you're going to have parties. You can't get away from them. And he writes in the Federalist, they're not useless. They are quite useful. Let ambition check ambition. If parties work right, and they haven't in the last 10 years, if they work right, you have one party actually fighting the other party. And then voters get a clear choice. They say, you know what, we like what this one over here is doing, not what that one's doing. And so I think we've seen, and this election was a clear testimony to that, that people were saying, we've sent people to Congress for 4 years now to stop this stuff, and they haven't done a thing. Let's try this Trump guy.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. So in some sense, would you say the second American party system is on the upswing a little bit just because people are willing to say, I'm tired of both parties looking so much the same?
Yeah, exactly. And that was what Van Buren had in mind. And it's worth it to your listeners to take just a minute and go into what he did, because Van Buren is far more important as a congressman than he ever was as a president. He follows Jackson as a president, but what he does in 1824 to put Jackson in office in 1828 was both brilliant and pretty sad, but we can't get away from it now.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, we're going to go to a break. We'll come back with Dr. Larry Schweikart, his book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Presidents. We'll come back right after this.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians that work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the moral choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all kids. This is how health care should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
Hi, I'm Kevin Sorbo. I wanted to invite you to offer your full support for the Ministry of Preborn and its leader, Dan Steiner. The team at Preborn is very focused and very successful at saving preborn babies from abortion. Now get ready to write down the phone number and the website so you can join the Preborn team.
Join Kevin Sorbo and me, Janet Mefford, as we support Preborn. The mission at Preborn is to supply pregnancy centers throughout America with sonograms. Ultrasounds are a game changer when it comes to saving babies' lives. You see, when an abortion-minded woman sees her baby on ultrasound and hears the heartbeat, she's 80% more likely to keep her baby. For $140, you can save five babies' lives. To donate, dial #250 and say keyword baby, or donate securely at preborn.com. Your love can save a life. Call 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229.
Every baby deserves to be born. God bless.
We are back on Janet Mefford today. We're talking with Dr. Larry Schweikert about his book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Presidents, Part 1, From Washington to Taft, and getting a little bit of a refresher course, or maybe for some, a first-time course in American history and some of the developments that have come our way. And we were talking a little bit about 1824 and the birth of the second American party system, and you had made the comment, Dr. Schweikert, that Van Buren was more important as a congressman than as a president. And I think that's kind of funny just because as a president, I'm not sure how many Americans could even list what Van Buren did, so maybe that makes
same
sense.
Same thing with John Quincy Adams. People know he was the president, but very few people know that he probably had more influence on the country as a congressman after he was president. He's the only American president ever to leave office and come back and be elected as a congressman, and he's involved in stopping the gag rule, and he's involved in the famous Amistad case. But what Van Buren does is to create a whole new political party in 1824 for the specific purpose of preventing a civil war. And he sees that as happening by virtue of the fact that he will reward people, no matter what their personal views on slavery are, he will reward you if you just shut up about slavery and make the system work. We're going to talk about slavery. We're not going to legislate slavery. And so if we help get you elected, you're going to be beholden to us, not to your own personal views, because we're going to pay the fiddler here. And so he creates the Democrat Party. But in the longer run, what that does is it causes big government.
Yeah.
Because to get elected, you have to promise jobs. And so every election, you promise jobs. Well, when you get an opposing political party called the Whigs in 1832, how are they going to get elected? Well, they've got to promise more jobs. So in each election now, you get this race to give away more and more jobs, and you can see it on charts. The government just starts to grow after that.
Right, right. Well, one of the things that you point out, for instance, about Jefferson is he's long been known for the quote that government is best which governs least. Did he even say that?
We can't find it anywhere. He probably believed something like that. But once again, as soon as he's in office, what does he do? Well, he correctly sends the Navy out on the first American war abroad to defeat the Barbary pirates.
Yeah.
And he does so without a declaration of war from Congress. He uses a joint resolution. And in fact, he says exactly what George W. Bush says in 2001. He says, if you're with the pirates of Tripoli, you're against us, and we're going to declare war on you too.
That's funny. Yeah. And history repeating itself in some respects. Yeah. Well, and I thought it was interesting when what you said about John Adams being the most unpopular of all the founders. Why?
Adams, he knew it. He was a prickly guy. He was very self-righteous, a little bit smug, very smart. He, for example, had the idea for independence, or was one of the first to voice it in 1776. He says, I can't announce this in the Continental Congress. Nobody will listen to me. So get Charles Lee from Virginia to put the motion before the floor, because if I put it before the floor, it'll be killed.
Right.
So he is quite unpopular, but he does keep us out of war. He negotiates that same line Washington does between England and France without starting a war.
Yeah, which is to his credit. He also left town, didn't he, before Jefferson's inauguration? He was no Obama, yeah. Apparently.
Yeah. Both he and John Quincy leave town before the inauguration.
What a concept. We need to reinstate that, maybe. That is interesting. I love this one, really cracked me up. James Madison, who I referenced earlier with Barney Frank, the father of the Constitution, you gave him a C+ constitutional grade, which I think I need an explanation for, because you'd think he would get an A+. Yeah.
One of those weird things, a guy writes the document and then he can't take the test, right? Madison is a very strange guy. He's not very commanding in his presence. I think one biographer of Hamilton described him as a crow standing next to Hamilton's peacock. he, of course, finds himself dragged into a war. He didn't want it, but he finds no other option there. And a lot of Madison's grade just kind of goes to the fact that the government is in such shambles and we're losing a lot of battles that he really doesn't have any way of getting a hold of this. And there's one scene in which poor Madison, as president, is in the saddle almost three straight days trying to catch up to the army, which is in retreat and broken up all over the countryside. And he leaves Monroe, his Secretary of State, who will be president, in charge in Washington. And the Secretary of War is gone, too. So James Monroe, in essence, at one time is president, Secretary of State, and Secretary of War all at the same time.
Huh. That is interesting. That's really interesting. The other thing that fascinated me was when you're talking about James Monroe. Here we've seen in recent weeks Barack Obama, accumulating more land in Utah, and this drove the politicians crazy out there, and adding more millions of acres of land out west, in particular, into government hands and all the rest. James Monroe seems to be the exact opposite; that he wanted to move as much land as possible into individual hands. How was that the case?
Right.
What did he do?
Well, Monroe, of course, presides over a great period of expansion, and he is a Virginian who has studied Jefferson, and this is very Jeffersonian doctrine that the people individually should hold the land, not the government. And, of course, Jefferson drafts the two most important pieces of land legislation in human history, the Land Ordinance of 1785 and the Northwest Ordinance, that basically finds a way to set up a process to hand government land over to people. No other government ever has really done anything like that. So Monroe goes all the way back to this Whig concept of government. He's a very non-activist president. He oversees Missouri Compromise and the addition of Missouri and Maine to the United States. He's the first president to visit most of the states. Madison goes to two sections of the country, but Monroe actually goes out and visits with the people. And these are very touching scenes. When Madison and Monroe visit, they will be introduced to lines of people, many of them veterans. And the veterans would come up, veterans even of the American Revolution, the War of 1812, and they would just come up and shake his hand and tell him what battle they were in just a couple of words, like, Yorktown, sir. Chippewa, sir. Brandywine, sir. And it's really heart-wrenching to think of these grizzled old guys just coming up meeting the president. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, it sure is. That's interesting. When we jump ahead to Abe Lincoln, because we can't ignore Abe Lincoln, obviously. One of the things you mentioned, Howard Zinn and the liberal historian that everybody was forced to read in school,
talked about the Emancipation Proclamation and made this claim that Lincoln was running out of men and needed black bodies in the army, and apparently that had something to do with the whole Emancipation Proclamation. What's the truth on that?
That is just the goofiest claim. In the first place, no one, either in the North or South, very, very few people, thought that blacks were capable of fighting like white soldiers. I mean, this is part of the racism, right? You can't have it both ways.
Right.
If he's a racist, he's not going to see them as capable of fighting. Second of all, Emancipation Proclamation, the preliminary is in September 1862. He's already come to the decision he's going to do that by about July. War's only 1 year old. We weren't running out of men anywhere by that time. So just across the board, it's a goofy thing.
Yeah. Now, how do you view Abe Lincoln historically in terms of his constitutional fidelity?
Well, I give him a very high grade because Lincoln sees his constitutional duty, as would I, number one, keep the country together. If the country is blown apart, then I don't care what else is in the Constitution, you fail. Because your first job as chief executive is to protect the country. And so he justified a lot of the things that other scholars have questioned about his, suppression of free speech and so forth.
Right.
He justified that as saying, hey, I'm following my first objective here of saving the country. And whether or not I am on firm constitutional grounds and all these other things, I will let the people decide in the electoral process, which, of course, they did.
Right. What about the habeas corpus issue?
Well, again, he treated it the same way. He would always say, I think I have the constitutional authority to do this, but until I get courts that rule on this and until we get elections, I'm going to go ahead until told otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. So the objective of keeping the states together was his driving, force, basically. That was his objective. And he achieved that. And we were able to defeat the grave sin of slavery over the years. When you look at the presidents in total, though, in this particular section of presidents, you say Teddy Roosevelt had as much influence on the presidency and the character of the presidency, than anybody else except Washington and Lincoln. Why is Teddy Roosevelt there?
Well, Roosevelt really, for the first time, personalizes the office around the individual there. You start to really get a sense that the presidency is not just some abstract office manned by someone you can't see, but it's that guy. It's Teddy Roosevelt. and he loves that kind of attention. He's, of course, the first president to go abroad. He goes to the Panama Canal Zone while the canal is being built. Well, I guess we shouldn't forget to mention this. Lincoln was the only president to hold a patent.
Yes, yes.
He had a patent for a device that would lift riverboats off sandbars. So anyway, Roosevelt is progressive. There's a lot of things he does that I don't like. I think they're not constitutional. But you got to love Roosevelt because he loved America. There's no question that Teddy Roosevelt loved America and thought what he was doing was going to help America and make America great again, right?
And to coin a phrase, right? Well, All these presidents, so interesting to read about. Dr. Larry Schweikert, great job. The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Presidents. Thank you, Dr. Schweikert. Great to have you.
Thank you, Janet.
All right, take care. We'll be back. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to 5 women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229 or visit preborn.com. We are back on Janet Mefford today. Well, if you love good preaching, then you probably love the Prince of Preachers, Charles Haddon Spurgeon. Many of us have delighted in reading his sermons and any number of books that have been released over the years. But up until now, a number of his early sermons have been lost to us all. My next guest, though, made an incredible discovery when he came across hundreds of Spurgeon sermons that had never been published before. And now these lost sermons are beginning to be published. Dr. Christian George is one of the world's foremost Spurgeon scholars. He's curator of the Spurgeon Library, as well as assistant professor of historical theology at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City. And he is out with the first of several upcoming volumes highlighting the newly discovered sermons of Charles Spurgeon. Very exciting. And the first of them is out now, The Lost Sermons of C.H. Spurgeon, Volume 1. And we are delighted to welcome Dr. George to the show. Great to have you here, Dr. George. How are you?
Thank you so much, Janet. I'm well, and yourself?
Just fine, and I'm thrilled about this. I love Spurgeon. This is so exciting for those of us who have really benefited from his sermons. Oh, yay, we get more to read.
Well, this book is a century and a half in the making, so
wow.
It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, tell us about these lost sermons, how you happened to discover them, because it would seem from a lot of the volumes that are already out that everything Spurgeon ever preached was compiled and put out in book form, but apparently not.
Well, you're right. A lot of Spurgeon is in book form. In fact, he published more words in the English language than any preacher in history.
Wow.
And so, you know, why do we need more words from Charles Spurgeon? I ask myself that every day. But in 1857, Charles Spurgeon tried to publish his earliest sermons. So everything we have of Spurgeon is from 1854 onwards, after he moves to the city of London. So these are his early sermons, never before been seen. And I was doing my PhD on Charles Spurgeon's Christology at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. My wife and I lived there for 3 years. And I took a research trip down to Spurgeon's College in South London. And it was there that I stumbled across these handwritten journals. And my first impulse, I looked at my wife. I about fell out of my chair. And my first impulse was to fulfill the wish that Charles Spurgeon had dreamed about so many years ago. And by the grace of God, these sermons are now being published in 12 volumes.
That is so neat. Well, now, if they had been there where you were able to find them, how come nobody previously found them and published them?
It's a great question. There's a lot of things there that, and throughout Britain, that need to be published. And so, you know, I just have to say, by the grace of God, they have been preserved, not for Spurgeon's day, but for our day.
Yes.
You know, and my hope is that God is up to something here.
Yes.
I tell people there's a thousand gears of grace that have rotated throughout a century and a half to make this project a reality. And I'm just happy to be a steward of this story.
That is so neat. So now tell people a little bit. I'm sure most people who are listening have heard of Charles Spurgeon, love Charles Spurgeon, have read him. But I know there are always people who say, who? I'm not sure who that is. But give us a little bit, if you would, of an overview of Charles Spurgeon and why he still matters in 2017.
Yeah, absolutely. So Charles Spurgeon lived in the Victorian era. He was born in 1834 and died in 1892, which means for those of your listeners who watch Downton Abbey, every one of those characters on that show would have been alive long enough to hear Charles Spurgeon preach.
Wow.
He lived in London. He was the most famous preacher of his day. When he was 21, a biography was written about his life. Like I said, he published quite a lot, 150 books, 63 volumes of sermons. I mean, the man, Janet, didn't have an unpublished thought.
Wow.
And but it's amazing just the reach of his ministry. An Australian who had been in prison escaped and actually murdered someone in cold blood, and he was looting the pockets of this victim and found a Spurgeon sermon in Australia and was converted just by reading the blood-stained sermon. And I could give you 50 other examples of just how God used this man in his day.
Oh, yeah. He was so gifted, and he had such a way with words. And you look at a Spurgeon sermon nowadays, I can think of many I've read online, and they're long. A lot of people I've heard look at Spurgeon sermons and they say, how could people have sat and listened to this for such a long time?
Sure.
What do you think about his delivery? Yeah. No internet.
Facebook.
Right. Yep.
Right. That probably helped. The Victorians had a longer attention span than we do, I'm afraid. And they knew their Bibles well also. And so, you know, Spurgeon never wanted to be famous. He wanted to be faithful. that was the orbit around which he rotated around, you know, the faithfulness. How do I respond to God's call in my life and be faithful to that? A biographer would later say that Charles Spurgeon's preaching was a combustion of two things, oxygen and grace.
Oh, wow.
And he used a lot of oxygen, and he often preached up to 12 times per week, a new sermon every time. Okay. But there was grace there, and there was healing for his world and ours.
Yeah, I like how you say he was born into an age of upgrade and downgrade. Now, we know about the downgrade controversy toward the end of his life, but what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so he was also born into an age that was coming into its own. You know, London was the biggest city in the world. Beijing overtook it around the 20th century. New York City overtook it kind of in the 19-teens. But when Charles Spurgeon moved to London in 1854, he could not have gone to a taller platform. And, of course, there was, you have to keep in mind, London during the 1850s and even up into the 70s, they didn't have things that we take for granted, like indoor plumbing, for instance.
Right.
I mean, London didn't even have a sewer system until, you know, the 1870s.
Wow.
And so Spurgeon moved to a very poor, thickly populated part of London, south of the Thames River. And that's where he had his ministry. And I love that about the man. You know, he does not go to the posh, the well-to-do part of London, north of the river, you know, where Big Ben is and all that. He goes to the ghetto. You know, 10,000 people died in a month, the first year he arrived from the cholera outbreak. And here is a man who is ministering to the sick and loving the wounded of his world in a new way.
That's incredible. Yeah, that does say a lot about him. What about the fact that you had said what we have of his sermons up until, you know, what you're publishing here of the early works is from 1854 onwards? Where was he? These sermons that you now have discovered and are beginning to publish, where was he ministering at the time that these were written and delivered?
Sure. Well, of course, Spurgeon goes to London, and he becomes known for his London ministry, which is what you referenced earlier. But he actually started in the country, in the Low Country. He started in the little villages around Cambridge. Some of them just have a few hundred people in them, like Waterbeach. And after Spurgeon was converted as a teenager, he accepted the pastorate of Waterbeach Chapel. And this was just a small congregation, really a thatched cottage is all it was. And Spurgeon preached as a teenager, you know, to these farmers and these agriculturalists about the love of Christ. And so he doesn't really start in the big city. I think that's often overlooked. You know, here is a country bumpkin, you might say, with a thick accent. You know, his wife, Susanna, when Spurgeon moves to London, his wife thought his accent was more of an affliction than a dialect. and so here you have, you know, someone from maybe the Duck Dynasty, you know, tribe living in Manhattan. I mean, he sort of sticks out.
Yes.
And yet he leveraged that from the gospel. And, you know, his biggest problem when he goes to London is, how do I find a building large enough to contain all these multiple thousands of people?
Yeah, with no microphone. He has to be able to...
With no microphone.
No microphone.
Exactly.
Yeah, so between 1851 and 1854, was he at Waterbeach Chapel that entire time period, or was he at other churches?
Yes, so at the very beginning, right after he is converted, he's baptized. He adopts the Baptist tradition. He was not a Baptist formally. And then he feels God's call in his life to start preaching the gospel. He doesn't exactly know what that's going to look like. I think very few people do. But he begins preaching itinerantly in some of these little villages. And so the very first volume of sermons we have records Spurgeon's earliest itinerant ministry before he takes the pastorate at Waterbeach. But in the main, all the sermons, all the rest of the sermons unfold there in Waterbeach Chapel. And this little chapel went from 30 people to 300 people in just about 2.5 years.
Goodness. That is something. Well, and it speaks to what sort of preacher he was. And there's more to talk about. We're going to come back with Dr. Christian George talking about the lost sermons of Charles Haddon Spurgeon. We'll be back right after this.
Many people in developing nations have no access to desperately needed medical care. That's why Mercy Ships brings volunteers aboard our hospital ship, the Africa Mercy, to give the world's forgotten poor the free medical care they need. We have an immediate need for registered nurses, especially with a pediatric specialty. As a volunteer nurse, you won't just give life-altering health care. You'll receive so much in return.
It's an amazingly rewarding experience.
You'll give hope and make a difference in the lives of those who have virtually no access to medical aid.
It's such a fantastic thing to do. Everybody who I've met on this ship either wants to come back and do it again, or they're already here for the second, third, or tenth time.
So what are you waiting for? Show mercy to someone today.
I would say go for it.
Get more information and learn how to apply by visiting mercyships.org/nurses. That's mercyships.org/nurses.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians that work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the moral choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all kids. This is how health care should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
I'm Janet Mefford today, and it is always wonderful for me to be able to read a sermon by Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the Prince of Preachers. And I know many of you also love and appreciate what he did, how he preached, and how so many of his sermons were preserved over the years for our benefit in 2017 America. But it's really neat to be talking, as I am, with Dr. Christian George. He's one of the world's foremost Spurgeon scholars, curator of the Spurgeon Library, assistant professor of historical theology at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's out with the Lost Sermons of C.H. Spurgeon and talking a little bit about how he found those. And this was, as you were mentioning, Volume 1, Dr. George, from his earliest itinerant ministry. Now, was it his pattern to write down every sermon in longhand before he delivered it, at least at that time period?
Well, it's interesting because his very first sermon, he was actually tricked into preaching his very first sermon that he had not prepared for that quite at all.
Oh, wow.
His mentor, the person who was kind of looking over his spiritual life in Cambridge at the church he was going to, he played a trick on him. You know, young Charles Spurgeon was told that his buddy, his friend, was going to be preaching. And so his friend was also told that Charles would be preaching. And so the both young men walked to this little cottage in Teversham, each thinking the other was going to preach. And so, you know, you can imagine the panic when they get to the door. Neither one had ever preached a sermon before. And Spurgeon said, well, you know, surely I can tell a few cottagers of the love of Christ. You know, and so his first sermon was really off the cuff. And many of his sermons afterwards were very extemporaneous and very conversational. But early on, when he started writing his sermons out by hand, he just made a few notes. He called them skeletons. Just a few outlines. But by the end of his ministry there in Water Beach, he was fully manuscripting his sermons, which he never did again after he moved to London. And so that's one of the unique things about this project. We get to see Spurgeon's longhand.
Yes. Yeah, you've got these facsimiles here. It's really a beautiful book. You can look, and I'm looking at one on his sermon on adoption. He had really good handwriting, by the way. It was really...
He did. Much better than mine.
And mine.
I was a teenager.
That is
we
so
great.
We
wanted to include... Yeah, those facsimiles, just to give people a flavor of the history we've been working with.
Yes. So what was your objective as you're going through these, what is it, 77 sermons in this first volume?
That's right.
Yeah, so you're trying to just kind of give people a feel for what was in the sermon. How did you approach kind of explaining the sermons when you were putting the book together?
Yeah. Well, look, this book is two things. This book is an academic work. In that, you know, we not only offer the original facsimile of the handwritten page, but I also transcribed on the other side of the page the exact words. And then after that, I also commentated on those words. And so Spurgeon often cross-references his own work in Scripture, and so there's commentary as well. But this book is also a labor of love, not just a labor of scholarship. You know, this is, we wanted to design this for anybody, for everybody. We wanted to make it full color, which is not easy to convince a publisher to do, but we wanted to make it affordable. We wanted pastors and really anyone to be able to pick this up and find the treasure within it. And so anybody can own and appreciate, I think, this piece of history.
Yes, it's really neat. I'm wondering, because you're such an expert on Spurgeon and you know so many of his later sermons so well, how these early sermons would compare in terms of content and depth and exposition. How do you see these sermons in comparison to the rest of the body of his work?
You know, I get that question a lot. And of course, I'm only deep in volume 3 now, so I still need to see what Spurgeon says later in his Water Beach ministry. But this is what I know. The sermons in his earliest ministry are some of the best that I have ever read. And I've read through every word of his sermons multiple times over the course of the last decade. They are passionate. I mean, here you have a man who at the center of himself is Jesus Christ, and he's urging people to find their center in Christ as well. And so I wake up early, Janet. I don't know what time you wake up, but I wake up around 1 o'clock in the morning, just about every morning.
Oh, wow.
And I work on this project. And I tell you what, by 6 o'clock, it is rare that I'm ever without tears.
Oh.
Turning the pages of these early sermons reduces me to weeping. They are one of the most heartfelt, gospel-drenched pieces of literature I've ever had the privilege of reading.
That's
great. So it's a truly humbling project.
I can imagine. Was there any particular sermon in this first volume that stuck out to you more than the rest?
Well, you know, first sermons are always important. And you had mentioned the sermon adoption. I think for me, you know, right when my eyes fell upon those words, you know, adoption was a theme in Spurgeon's later ministry. He started 2 orphanages, actually, when he went to London many years later. And some of those orphans, you know, barely lived into their 20s. Many of them were chimney sweepers. If you've ever seen Mary Poppins, you know,
sure,
just how terrible a chimney sweeper's life was.
Yeah.
They died of cancers and all sorts of terrible things. And so from the very beginning of his ministry, he has an eye toward taking care of other people. You know, he believed every single life in this world is precious because it's made in God's image. And he even risked his reputation and all of his finances because he believed so very much in that.
That's neat. Yes, he did so many incredible things. Can you tell from the early sermons what his influences were? Clearly the Word of God, that goes without saying, but does he reveal much about himself in the sermons? That
he does. This has been one of the most fascinating things. You know, the question, how does Spurgeon become Spurgeon?
Yes.
I mean, these early sermons show us how. Of course, he's saturated in the Word of God. He has a photographic memory, by the way, Janet. Mm-hmm. He never forgot anything, which probably... you know, I wish I could say that about myself.
Yes.
Spurgeon said he could hold 8 thoughts in his mind in a single moment and choose one as from a shelf.
Wow.
And so you're working with clearly, you know, the Leonardo da Vinci of preaching here. He's a genius. But, you know, I also think some of his early influences were the Puritans. Mm-hmm. He's starting to read people like John Bunyan, The Pilgrim's Progress.
Yes.
Which was the most popular English really allegory in the history of the language, second only you know, to the publication of Scripture. And so he's influenced by the very best that England could produce. And I think that had a tremendous influence on his own language and his own style and his own theology.
Wow. And do you detect in the sermons any spiritual change in him as you're going through, that he's getting deeper in this area or he's understanding this in more depth, or you know what I'm saying, in the whole context of his work, how he developed as a preacher along the way and as a Christian himself?
I mean, that's a question I ask myself every day. You know, how is Spurgeon growing?
Yes.
How is he growing inwardly? How is he growing outwardly? Remember, he's just a 16-year-old when he begins. One of the things that we're doing is we're triangulating these early lost sermons with other letters, with other diary entries, with other autobiographical content, so that we can really fix Spurgeon in history. We can see where he's growing, how he's responding to his environment. You know, Spurgeon, he had warts, Janet. You know, he didn't just have dimples. And he struggled, like any teenager, like any person. He struggled with pride. You know, that was one of his greatest sins. He called it his darling sin. And so it's been so fascinating to read some of these little annotations he makes at the end of his sermons about, you know, begging God to take this this sense of self-elevation out of him so that he can give himself completely to other people. And so I think that's one area of progress that I'm particularly interested in as well.
That's great. That's great. And kind of strikes home for us all that he was a human being and a sinner like everybody else. He was an extraordinary person, but also desperately needed the love of Christ and Christ's salvation himself. What do you say to people who've never read Spurgeon? I mean, besides saying, what's wrong with you? But I mean, to say...
I don't say that too often, but maybe sometimes.
Yeah, maybe that's a little...
You know, I say read the man. You know, here you have somebody who lived in the reality of the cross. Mm-hmm. Here you have someone with real concrete answers for some of the greatest evils of his day and our day. I mean, you can draw a line from the 21st century to the Victorian era. I mean, they were suffering from terrorism in the Middle East, just like mm-hmm. we are. There was racial tension. Spurgeon was born 1 year after William Wilberforce died.
Oh, wow.
Right as slavery was being abolished. And so I tell people, just read his sermons. There's one particular sermon I like to read called The Dying Thief in a New Light. And Spurgeon has a way of sucking you into the presence of Christ.
Yes, he does.
And showing you emotionally, passionately, that we are nothing without the grace of God.
And wonderful.
And that changed his whole world, and I think it can change our world too.
Oh, I think so. What a gorgeous book and just such a treasure, The Lost Sermons of C.H. Spurgeon. This is Volume 1. There are more to come, but Dr. Kristen George has been kind enough to join us. Dr. George, wonderful work, and it was such a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Janet.
God All right. Bless. God bless you too. Thanks for being with us. And thanks for joining us here on Janet Mefford Today. Lord willing, we'll be back again with you next time. Check us out at janetmefford.com.